Welcome to the KMOX Home Improvement Show.
Presented by Suburban Leisure Center, the place with the big red chair.
Now, Scott Mosby on the voice of St. Louis KMOX.
All right, good Saturday afternoon, everybody. I am Rich Orris, filling in for Scott Mosby again, and welcome to the KMOX Home Improvement Show. And today, boy, got a lot that we can go over for the next 2 hours. We can talk, obviously, anything about your home. How did Easter go? You know, did you pay attention to what's working or not working while you were entertaining over the holidays? The weather, obviously, has been quite unpredictable lately. So cool, then warm, and rainy, then dry. So, you know, we can really, as you're looking around, have you found any new leaks around the house from any of these spring rains we've been getting? We've had some pretty decent sized storms roll through and everything. So we can talk about all of this and more as we go through the next couple hours here together. So you can give me a call, 314-436-7900, anything you need, or from far away, 800-925-1120. We've got a lot, you know, on the horizons for our home. We can touch on a lot of that stuff today. We all want to be outside. Every chance we get, it's turning nicer. You know, we start thinking about all of these outdoor living projects. Do you have something that, you know, you're considering for this year, maybe starting or trying to accomplish, you know, outside your home? Are you thinking about a new patio or maybe covering an existing patio, or maybe expanding that grilling area into an actual outdoor kitchen prep area? You know, things just like you can do inside, you can do outside. So we got a lot of information like that for you today. But as always, my primary position here is to help you with whatever ails you about your home. So feel free. I'm here for you for the next two straight hours. 314-436-7900 is where you can find me, or 800-925-1120. And, you know, thinking about spring and getting into, you know, everything going on, the water, the rain, how do you get it away from your house, all these things going on, getting it through and everything. There's a lot that we can go through and cover today, you know, as spring keeps developing a lot closer towards summer. So, in speaking of water, we have Paul on the line, has a question about a drain. Hey, Paul, are you there? Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, my question is actually about a ridge vent.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah. So, my daughter lives in a Whitaker home in O'Fallon and has an attached two-car garage that's unfinished. And it's very hot in the summer, so we're going to add a ridge vent. However, when we got up on top and looked at the walls where the truss meets the wall, there appears to be a 2x4 that's like at a 90-degree angle to the roof that blocks the soffit area. So I don't know how we would get ventilation up through the soffit. Is that common or is that weird?
Usually when they do that, they would put some holes or something in it to let air in. It is commonly put there sometimes to just kind of help with racking and stuff like that. But it is, you know, newer homes, it is a little less common, you know, that they're doing any of that anymore, because with trusses, you put that racking, you know, inside the trusses and you don't have to worry about it being between them as often. But yeah, it would be worth getting down there, you know, on those eaves if you can from the inside, and maybe drilling some holes, you know, through those 2x4s to let air in, to really get it through. And to match a ridge vent, you would need, you know, you'll never match it with drilling, but you'll need a lot of holes, as many as you can get. You know, because really you want a 2-inch wide opening all the way down the whole side of that garage at the bottom, and that's what matches up at the top. And then you got to remember, too, you know, go outside and look at what is on the home, is there like a soffit and fascia material on the home, and is that material vented or is that blocking air also?
Yeah, it is perforated, which really made me wonder why the 2x4s are blocking. So, okay, and what about Solvol, cut the 2x4 and rip it out, like every other one or something?
That would be a good idea, too. I would still drill a few holes in the ones you don't rip out.
Okay.
And I would definitely, you're on the right track. I would not advise ripping them all out, just depending on, you know, why they put them in there.
Yeah.
Typically, they always went in there because if you didn't enclose the soffit, you know, it was basically called a bird block. It kept birds and things like that from coming in. And, you know, when they used it for that, you know, so it could have also been somebody just putting them in there, not knowing what the rest of the finishes of the house were going to be when it was built. And they just threw them in and then realized later, oh, we didn't need those, but oh well. You know, why go back and take them out when, you know, you're ruining ventilation and all of that. So, yep. You are
all right.
Definitely
excellent.
Headed in the right direction with what you're thinking. You know, and does that garage have a ceiling in it? Is there a drywall ceiling or is it just open rafters?
All open, right.
Yep, so that will help draw, you know, a lot of that air through there and out of there as all that heat rises. It'll draw out that ridge vent. So definitely will help and a good thing to do.
Okay,
all right, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Hey, no problem. You are very welcome. Great question. On the right track, definitely. You know, thinking the right way. And it's amazing how, you know, even in our building industry, you know, our builders, all the different trades don't always think the right way on things like that. They, you know, they basically, you have a carpenter, he's been framing, he's been building, he does this and he does that job. And, you know, everybody does their own. The roofer may put on a ridge vent, but he doesn't do the lower siding and the intake and all of that. Or the insulator may blow in insulation and not put the baffles and block off what the sider and the roofer did correctly. And then you've got insulation blocking and getting in the way. So sometimes in our industry, you know, we can actually get in our own way, kind of step on our own toes as we're trying to walk in order to finish out, you know, how these jobs work correctly. That kind of shows that proof of, you know, find somebody that understands everything as a whole, that knows the whole system, that talks, you know, well and educated wise on, you know, how these things need to work, and ask them, you know, some good open-ended questions like that to see how their answers come out, to kind of find out, do you really feel like they know what they're talking about? Because we trip ourselves up. Like I said, you get all these different trades. They're all subcontractors. They do their part. They're not really concerned about the before person's part or the next person's part. And that's where things can really get tricky and go wrong. So if you have anything else like that, hey, give me a call. Let's talk it out today. 314-436-7900 is where you can find me. We got a lot of show left, but we're going to take our first break. And we'll get back into more right after this.
This is the KMOX Home Improvement Show.
Presented by Suburban Leisure Center. The place with the big red chair.
Now, Scott Mosby on the voice of St. Louis KMOX.
All right, guys. Rich Orris here filling in for Scott Mosby today. Got a ton going on. Got some calls coming in already. You know, friends, family, everyone, keep those calls coming in. We got a lot of show left. 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. And speaking of the phones, let's go straight to Abdi and see what's going on with his driveway. Are you there?
Yes, I'm. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Oh, yeah. No problem. Thank you for calling.
Hey. Yeah, well, I spoke with you about a week ago, but I saved this question for you for later. Hey, I have a concrete driveway that was being put about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
So some of the areas of that concrete driveway started to kind of like, you know, disintegrating the surface of the concrete, like literally kind of like eroding out.
Okay, gotcha.
And I don't know where the phenomenon is coming from. I didn't expect that thing to start doing that at this really fairly new concrete driveway. So what went wrong here, and what do I really need to do? Any suggestions?
So where you're seeing this concrete eroding out, I mean, basically, when you see the chunks coming out, do you see kind of like rocks underneath there where you're looking at kind of
No,
like
this? It is a junk coming off the top, the surface.
Yeah. So generally, is those kind of like what we call spalling, where just circled area chunks will just come out of that, top surface of that driveway, is generally a freeze thaw cycle kind of thing. Why that takes place a lot. So if it was new about a year and a half ago, and this past winter we had some really cold, times throughout the winter, and in St. Louis we have a lot of freeze-thaw cycles, basically where it freezes overnight, but it gets kind of warm again towards the afternoon. So the moisture that gets in that concrete will freeze, expand inside the pores of the concrete. Generally, a lot of times there's like a rock down below, because there's like limestone rocks inside the concrete, and those limestone rocks are also very, absorbent. They'll take in, a lot of moisture too, a lot of water, and then they expand, they put pressure on the concrete, and then it, thaws out the next day, pressure goes away, next night does it again. That happens, anywhere from like 50 to 60 times over the course of a winter in St. Louis on average. So it puts a lot of pressure on the top surface of that concrete. So, and salt from the streets, if you get snow, ice, stuff like that, if you use regular rock salt, that can kind of deteriorate that surface and kind of speed up the process. So, and even if you use the right stuff, but when you drive on the streets, the salt from your car kind of comes up with you, drives on the tracks, things like that, where your tires are kind of always on your driveway. That can help, put salt there and cause these things to happen too. Really, the only thing that you could do right now to try and slow it down and prolong the life of that concrete is to seal it with a sealer and try and keep as much of that moisture out of the pores of that concrete as possible.
Yeah, that's well, the interesting part of this is that I understand, I think, the salt part of it, but the area in which these things start to kind of getting bad, it is the area that we don't even park the vehicle at all.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It is the close to the house area. Nobody even used other than being people walking on it. Mm-hmm. And I just like, what the hell is this? We put some salt on that area during the winter times. But again, yeah, so you're just saying like, go ahead, do resealing again? Is that,
Yeah, I would seal the concrete. They do make sealers that are clear, kind of like a silicate base, that actually soak in and fill up the pores of the concrete. So you don't really see, it's not a top coat sealer that's like real glossy or anything. It actually soaks in, you spray it on, it fills up the pores and everything. And the way to know it's still there and still working is to kind of, spray some water on it and see if it's beating up instead of soaking in. That sealer, a really good one, could last 5 years or so. But the best way to do it is just, every year, a couple times a year, spray some water on it and see if it's looks like it's soaking the water in, or is it beating up and wanting to roll off? And then I would definitely suggest going to like the snow melt that's in like the magnesium type family, something like that. So try and stay away from actual rock salt. And go with, there's different types of little white pellets that snow melt that's, in a magnesium, potassium type family that doesn't do nearly as much damage to the concrete or grass plants around it, things like that, as the salt does. And then the only other thing you could have going on that, you know, it's going to be the same recommendation with what to use for snow melt and what to use for sealing, but it's just the mixture of the concrete. You know, who did the concrete and how good is that concrete? Because when you order concrete from, you know, a concrete yard, the concrete company tells them what they want in it. It drives the cost. So they, you know, the more Portland you put in there, the harder and better that concrete's going to be. But the less you put in there, the less that concrete's going to cost. So different concrete companies, you know, might use like a different concrete mix. And there's also like gravel that goes in there where some of it's state approved, that it's a good gravel. It has less dust and dirt and things like that in the gravel that can deteriorate the, you know, life expectancy of that concrete, having a cheaper gravel. So going with the state approved limestone, going with, you know, more Portland, getting to like a 4,000 pound pressure, what they call, you know, or higher concrete, also helps the length and life expectancy of that surface and that concrete also. So that's a question, because you don't know what they did.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. We discussed that in length, that they were telling me they have the best one they can get it. But again, I was thinking about resurfacing it, but you're saying like you just don't really need to go to that far. You just do sealing, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. I think that would be good enough. Anything you try and put on top or you know, add to it, or if you try and fill a lot of those divots with some kind of, you know, concrete or something like a hydraulic cement patch or something like that, it just breaks back out and it's more opportunity for water to get underneath there and pop it back out anyway. So anything you try and fix it with, it usually comes back out.
Okay. We'll do the sealing resealing then, I guess.
All right. Great. Appreciate the call, MD. Really good question and a hot topic here in St. Louis.
Oh, yeah. Love it, guys. Your show, it's a really good show. Thank you.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you, sir. And for everybody else out there, we got plenty of show, plenty of time left. You can give me a call today, 314-436-7900. Join in, get in the conversation. We've got plenty to go over, but we would love to hear from you. So I think we're going to take our middle hour break now, and while we await to get some of these calls and maybe some more topics when we come back.
This is the KMOX Home Improvement Show.
Presented by Suburban Leisure Center. The place with the big red chair.
Now, Scott Mosby on the voice of St. Louis KMOX.
All right, guys, here we go. Rich Orris here, filling in for Scott Mosby today. Taking a little well-deserved time off and things like that. So love getting into the show, into the conversation, the questions, and really trying to, you know, help all our KMOX friends out here. And if you've got anything else for us, again, remember, you can jump right in. 314-436-7900 is where you can get to me. And speaking of getting to me, we've got Rick on the phone here with a question. So, Rick, are you there? Thanks for calling.
Hi. Is it Rick?
It's Rich. Rich.
Yeah, okay, Rich. Thanks for taking my call. So my garage water gathers in there when the snow melt, you know, and puddles up.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed around the edges that it's below the original line. And so anyway, I'm wondering about raising that, or do you worry about that? What's a guy do?
So you're saying the garage floor is starting to sink? You can kind of.
I would say it has. You know. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. And garages are very easy to tell that, because when you're up against that foundation, yeah, you can usually see like the line where they stroke that concrete up against the inside of that foundation. Same thing with sidewalks and stuff right against the foundation. You can usually see that strike line where it used to be,
yes,
and you can see
Rich,
it going down.
You can see that,
yep.
And it has sunk a little bit. And I noticed there's also a little chipping on the floor at where the foundation and the floor meet, going on. So, anyway, that's, I'm just wondering about raising it, or do you fool with it? What do?
So if it, and you, so you were also saying that you get some like water at the edge of that garage floor, from like snow melt and stuff like that off the cars, like, is the water not leaving the garage out the door?
Correct, Rich. It puddles in the, near the center. Of the garage.
Yep. So it would be, I mean, that floor is meant to, you know, slope away, go towards that garage door. It is very common when you get to the garage door, you know, the way they're troweling it out and everything, that, you know, you get a little spot where it can't necessarily leave from the garage floor to the driveway very easily. And in that case, as I would say, or even in yours, for the time being, whenever you can, squeegee that water out of there just to get it off and to try and kind of dry it out. But it would be a good idea to try and lift that garage floor, if you can, back to where it used to be, in order, if that would help, you know, get that water running where you want it to run. And there's basically two ways you could do this. And one's kind of, I don't want to say trial and error, but might necessarily last as long as the other. But so you can mud jack that garage floor and you can raise that thing back up. If you're getting water underneath that garage floor, if there's a reason that something is happening to cause this garage floor to sink, there's, you know, that mud jacking, and there's a poly jacking too, that's a little bit better, works a little bit better, and can maybe marginally hold up a little bit longer. But if your base underneath there is sinking and that garage floor is going with it, and you raise it back up temporarily by pumping a something underneath it, it will probably sink again. And that could be okay. You can either mud jack it again, or you might get to a point where you end up just tearing out that garage floor, digging it out, getting a good, you know, rock base underneath it, tamping it really well, and pouring a new garage floor, and that might last more years than the mud jacking. But it's kind of like you get what you pay for. It's going to cost, you know, way more than the mud jacking. So some people look at it and think, well, I could mud jack this thing, you know, three times every, you know, 5 years over the next 15 years, still have a garage, you know, level garage floor each time I do it. And then I'm at the end of 15 years and I've still spent less than that new concrete possibly. So it's really, how long are you staying? What value, you know, are you really after in that? But I would definitely recommend, if it's holding water like that, looking into a way to get that water out of there.
Yes, it's a pain. I sweep it out or squeegee it out, what have you. But, and I don't think that there's water I'm kind of at the top of a hill, so I don't think that I have water getting in on, you know, around the foundation or what have you. It's just, and the house is right at 30 years old. So I guess I'll look into reaching out to a mud jacker and see what happens.
Yep. I would definitely start there and see, you know, what they think and getting it back up and everything. And, you know, it's definitely a good route to go. Sealing that concrete isn't nearly as important as like the driveway and stuff like that that we were talking about, you know, earlier, because inside that garage, I mean, you can seal it, but they put that slick trowel finish, and that's why it holds that water so well, because it's, you know, the pores are more closed off, and that slick trowel finish, that water will flow and hold and go, you know, easier than like on the driveway with a broom finish or a swirl finish or something like that. I wouldn't jump into sealing it. I don't know that that's going to help you nearly as much as it would like on the driveway, but keeping it level and working is going to be your best friend.
Rich, thank you so much for your time, and we appreciate your show.
Hey, absolutely. No problem. Great question. Appreciate the calls. For everybody out there, feel free to, you know, jump on in. 314-436-7900. Bring you right to me. But, you know, another thing with those garage floors that I can say is, you know, when they build houses, a lot of times that garage is kind of the dig down access into where they get into the whole foundation area. So as they dig it out and everything, they'll kind of put a ramp from that garage so they can drive a Bobcat down into that basement area, drive around, smooth out rock, you know, do work very easily with a Bobcat. Then they can drive back out. So it is very common that the garage floors have a lot of fill underneath them. And that, you know, that fill, if it's not tamped well, if it's, you know, wasn't done really well at the first time they did it, or if it's dirt that they put back, you know, when you do fill like that, you're going to have concrete on it. You want to do like big rocks, medium rocks, smaller rocks. There's a certain way to do that all the way up. So if they're putting any dirt back in there, that can really cause, you know, a lot of settling and that concrete dropping. And in that situation, if you don't dig down far enough, whether you do new concrete or mud jacking, if your settling is occurring 4 feet or 5 feet deep because of dirt compacting that was, you know, dug out, put back, you know, dirt has a lot of, when they do that with the ground, it gets a lot of oxygen in it. So it really, like, it fluffs up about, you know, 60% bigger once you dig it out than being compacted and being in the earth the whole time. So if you do go back with dirt, you'd really almost have to pile that up. Like if you're down 10 feet, you have to pile up 6 feet of dirt and compact down or let it compact down over time in order to prevent settling like that. So a lot of that could be just backfill, things like that. Also, I've seen entire slab homes where I saw a kitchen dining room area on a foundation, but it was a slab floor. And I'm telling you, this floor was floating 20 inches off. It was like a crawl space underneath the concrete. But when it was built, it wasn't like that. The dirt was to the surface. The rock was, you know, they put like a 4-inch rock base, but it was all backfill, and it dropped almost 2 feet from the bottom of the concrete and was kind of suspended in the middle of nowhere. It wasn't really built to do that. So you got to watch what, you know, everything's as good as its base, everybody. You know, make sure you get that well and you do, you know, do everything right underneath, because it doesn't matter how good what you put on top. Same thing with like roofing shingles. You know, when your roof goes bad, if you do and overlay new shingles on top of bad shingles, basically it takes the life expectancy of the new shingle down in about half. So if you're getting like a 30-year shingle, you can expect about a 15-year life expectancy out of a recover because of what's underneath it isn't good, brittle, you know, a lot of asphalt gone, stuff like that. So that's the theory. Everything is as good as what you put underneath it. You know, that's on top. So consider that. While you're considering that, consider calling in, getting some phones. We're going to get into a break here. But again, 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120 is where you can find me. And we'll have more right after these messages.
This is the KMOX Home Improvement Show,
presented by Suburban Leisure Center, the place with the big red chair.
Now, Scott Mosby on the voice of St. Louis KMOX.
All right, guys, here we go. Rich Orris here, filling in for Scott Mosby today, having just a grand old time. You know, so last night, it was a nice evening, taking a walk with the family. I'm sure there's so many people that do this. So you're walking, you're looking. Look at your own house is a great thing to do. Walk around it. Just kind of take a peek. See if you notice anything going on, stuff like that. But, you know, as we're walking through the neighborhood, we're kind of looking at all the houses and, you know, seeing some of the different things. And, of course, I'm noticing, you know, it's spring. you start to see this, you know, every spring you're like, oh, yeah, that house could really use some power washing on the north side, you know, getting that algae on the vinyl siding and everything. And that algae will get on just about any surface. It's not, you know, composite surface, things like that. It can grow on top of anything if the conditions are right. So there's nothing that's really going to absolutely stop that. And I know last week we were kind of talking about, you know, what not to do when power washing. And so I kind of thought, you know, let's kind of look at what should you do? Like, you know, what is a great way to power wash well, especially with, you know, any type of vinyl siding for sure. Any of like metal, older steel siding, anything that has seams in that, even your newer Hardy board, LP smart side stuff, you got to watch that you're not pushing water, you know, where you don't want it through and around that siding. So as you're starting out, the first thing, you know, I would recommend when you're going to clean off that algae off the side of your house on your siding, you know, start off with an actual cleaner. You know, you want to make sure you get something that's going to help you get this stuff off so that you're not just using the water pressure, because you don't want to use too much. So you know, get the house wet, follow the directions from the actual composite cleaner, you know, soak it on there, spray it on there. There is kind of like an activate time you want to find out from each one. You know, let it soak for 15, 20 minutes, you know, whatever they recommend. This is steps you can repeat too. So if it doesn't quite do it all, you can try it again, soak it again, you know, run another time. But that will definitely help break that stuff. A lot of times you'll just start seeing that color run down the wall just from the soap and everything. Makes it much easier. If you do need to scrub, especially, you know, on vinyl siding, you want to make sure that you avoid anything that's, you know, highly abrasive. You're going to want like a soft bristle, you know, vinyl bristled kind of scrub brush. You can put it on a long paint pole, extended paint pole, makes it easier, and kind of scrub some of that off there with that, you know, soap on there. A lot of times I wait till the second try for the scrubbing. Try it once, let it soak, power wash it off. If there's still some, then you're scrubbing a little bit less of an area. But you want to make sure that when you are running the power washer, you know, so while you're washing, be sure to keep that stream pointed straight at that vinyl siding. You don't want to, you know, have that at an upward angle. You want it straight on, straight at it. You don't want to force that water up, you know, inside that siding if you can help it. When you're washing and you're going kind of side to side, always go, you know, with the seams, not against them. So you're crossing the seam, you know, and not spraying water directly in towards that seam, driving it in, you know, behind that siding. Also, you want to watch how much pressure you have, how close you're getting, that sort of thing, because you can damage the siding, create lines in it, take off some of the finish. And really, you don't want to see all those strokes and lines and where you'd been power washing. And another thing I would recommend is, you know, especially if you're renting equipment, you don't use hot water. There's a lot of like commercial grade equipment and washers out there. There's probably some, you know, that you could rent. And those you can, you know, have hot water with. But I'd say leave that, you know, to your pros. You know, make sure you don't want to, if you get it too hot, you can actually warp and you know, melt that siding and do a lot of damage to it that way. So you really want to watch and be particular, you know, how you do that, and don't use too hot of water. So I'd say stick with a regular one, stick with cold water, and just run through the cycle two, maybe even three times if you have to, you know, get it all off with less damage. Now, the other thing you want to think about is, you know, what's below this. If it's a nice grassy area, it's going to soak in well. But if you're at a spot in the house where, you know, you have some plant, you have some landscape, some things like that. Some people, you know, they might have, you know, a garden they put on the side of the home, kind of a little built-up garden or something. So you want to watch to protect that stuff, you know, from this these cleaners also. You know, you want to make sure so you can tarp over them, maybe put some stakes and stuff to help hold the tarp up, and just really kind of protect what you're doing, you know, down below so that you're not, you know, damaging any of your plants, gardening, or anything like that, you know, underneath where you're washing. So take a look around, check it out. The other thing I always, you know, kind of recommend in the spring too is to, when you're taking that look around, you know, sometimes you just need to either do it right after, or I always recommend during, grab an umbrella and just get out there during a rainstorm and really just see, you know, what are your gutters doing? How are things happening? Is there puddling around the foundation or in the yard anywhere? You know, things like that. Is your grade working? All of that. You want to check that out. And the best time to do it is really, you know, when it's happening. I'll never forget years ago at one of my older homes we had, I pulled up to the garage. It was pouring down rain. We'd bought the home pretty new. Trees were very small, very young when we first bought the home. So now it's been like 10 years. I don't even realize that my trees are like taller than my roof now. And I come home and the water is just cascading out of my gutter in front of the garage. And my wife was like, yeah, that's been doing that. And I'm like, well, yeah, good heads up would be great. Because if you don't know and you don't think about it and you don't see it, you know, then you don't know that you really need to do something about it. So, of course, I was up there first chance I got cleaning out the gutters and doing that. And I'm like, wow, my trees are so tall now. I just didn't realize. And now I want to think about some kind of gutter covers or something to protect that. So, hey, we're going to get into our 1 hour break here. But for everybody out there, feel free. We got a whole nother hour, 314-436-7900. We're going to take the news break and everything. And we'll be right back after all that.
So you've decided.
Welcome to the KMOX Home Improvement Show.
Presented by Suburban Leisure Center. The place with the big red chair.
Now, Scott Mosby on the voice of St. Louis KMOX.
All right, friends and family, surprise, surprise, Rich Orr is still here filling in for Scott Mosby today. And if you have anything for me, questions, comments, tips, concerns, anything going on around your house, jump right in. Give me a call, 314-436-7900. We have Jerry on the line, has a tip for us all, I believe. Jerry, are you there?
I sure am.
Hey, thanks for calling. What do you got?
Well, if you want to get rid of the green algae on the side of your house, or the black on top of your roof, or the black on your driveway, there's a product called Wet and Forget. You either put it on your hose end sprayer. They got one for your hose end sprayer. It'll spray 30 feet up. Or you get one for your pump sprayer and just spray it on and walk away and forget it and let the sun and the rain take care of it.
Wow, that's nice. Well, yeah, because not everybody has a power washer, you know, or the wands to go 20-something feet in the air, you know, also.
Yeah. So, but this is a heck of a lot easier, and it's about $25 a gallon, whatever it is. I think you mix it 3-to-1, something like that.
Sure, absolutely.
But I've been using this stuff for several years, and it's great. If you got a real big bad buildup, you may have to do it a couple times, but it's, you know, in 20 minutes you can do your whole damn house.
Awesome. Hey, that's a great tip, Jerry. Really appreciate it. Thanks for the call.
Lowe's and Ace and Menards, they've all got it.
No, and those cleaners are definitely key to, you know, making things easier on yourself and everything to do. There's a lot to be said for all of that, for sure. So,
it sure makes your concrete look new.
Yeah, that concrete can be hard to get that off of, too, even with a power washer and stuff. So any advantage to getting through that would be super helpful. So, cool. Appreciate
it. Okay.
All right. Thank you. Yep, you're welcome. Have a good day. Thanks for calling. And we have a call coming in here about a ceiling fan, I believe. Hey, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. What's your name?
Kay.
Oh, hey, Kay. How are you doing?
Pretty good, sir. How are you today?
I am great.
Wonderful.
What do you have going on?
Well, I have ceiling fans, and I've had them for a while, and I haven't found anything that says if you should have any kind of regular maintenance. I have one that's making noises now when it rotates.
Okay.
Almost like it might be off center or you need oiling. I don't know, because I've not found anything that says, yes, this kind of maintenance needs to be done after so long.
Yeah, you know, and really, I haven't seen anything either that I know of, other than, you know, if they start to get out of balance, you can, you know, put the balancers on the blades and stuff. But I don't know that you can really get to the motor and stuff very much. And I've never really seen any type of maintenance list on what to do to, you know, help the life expectancy of ceiling fans, which is, you know, kind of a shame because, you know, it's kind of like that throwaway society that we've all turned into where, you know, you just constantly replacing things.
You exactly.
Know, they just don't last, you know, like they used to. And it's just, you know, kind of a shame because we're going to fill our landfills up with refrigerators, water heaters, and ceiling fans because I just changed two ceiling fans in my house for newer ones because they were just old. And yeah, they start to, you know, rub and things and make noise. And, you know, we just
is that
switch
like
them
you
out.
Said, could it be out of balance? I mean, is there? I've never heard of blade balancers, but can I get them someplace? Or
yeah, they're just like little weights that you put up there, and basically that's if you see it wobbling. You know, if when it's running, if you see a wobble in it where it's just unsteady, it's not just like real smooth. And I've literally seen people like tape or hot glue a quarter, you know, or something like that, or a washer on top of one blade, and you just see if it starts to take that wobble, and if it takes half the wobble out, well, then you need to put another one or whatever, and it'll kind of balance that, you know, unit.
Okay.
Yep. But that's really all I've ever seen as far as I've never, you know, seen anything on how to, you know, lube them up. You can try maybe just shooting in like a silicone spray, you know, around it or something.
I'd be afraid of hitting something I shouldn't.
Well, I'd be. That's why I said silicone spray instead of WD-40 because at least it's clear. You know?
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah, so if it drips a little bit out later or something, you never want to use a lot. But, yeah, you start dripping WD-40 out later and you're going to wish you hadn't, you know, for sure. Yeah. So other than trying some silicone spray, I don't have a whole lot for you on ceiling fans.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
No problem. You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
All right. You take care.
Yep. Great question. Something we should probably come up with, you know, what should we be doing, you know, to our ceiling fans to make them last longer? It'd be great if we could get, you know, everything to last a little bit longer these days. So we've got Jim on the line. Let's go to Jim and see what he has going on. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hey, I've got a walkout basement. The house is like almost 15 years old. It was never finished, and I want to finish the walkout basement. My question is about insulating the walls near the foundation that's below grade. Do I need to put a vapor barrier in or not?
No. So you in a basement finish like that or really in our climate, anywhere inside the house, no matter what floor you're on, including the basement, you do not want to install any type of vapor barrier at all.
Okay. So anywhere, you know, because, okay. So anywhere that's any of the exterior walls or actually the wall up against the foundation, that should not be have a vapor barrier.
Correct. The only thing I would say that in a basement as far as trying to protect from, you know, any moisture or doing any type of barrier like that, if you want to, I would say you can paint the foundation walls before you build the basement with like a dry lock paint, or you could seal them with a sealer to just kind of try and keep the moisture on the other side of the concrete, you know, from actually permeating through. But on your walls, on your framing, on the back of your drywall, or on any insulation, you know, that you put in, you never really want a vapor barrier, because you want the moisture vapor to be able to escape from that wall system.
Right.
And, you know, basically what we figured out in the St. Louis area, you know, and what they figured out about houses scientifically over the years is, when you do, when a vapor barrier is installed correctly and it's effective, it's on the warm side of the wall. So if you were, you know, living in a very, very cold climate where it never got over 70 degrees, you would put it inside your house because it would always be warmer on the inside. Or if you were somewhere very hot and it never got below 80 degrees, you'd put it on the outside. So for us, that switches with the seasons. So it actually creates condensation and stuff like that inside the wall system. That's why we've turned to like the house wrap, that it's actually breathable. It goes on the outside, but it lets moisture vapor out and holds water away. So be same thing with your foundation. If you put it on the inside of the foundation, you paint on that dry lock, I think you'll be pretty good to keep that moisture on that side. Another thing I'd recommend is any cracks that you see is just go ahead and have them epoxy injected.
Right.
You know, if they're below grade, even if they're not leaking, if they start leaking, you're going to wish they hadn't. So just, you know, it's a great idea to epoxy inject those before you build a wall in front of it, just to be sure it's a few hundred bucks that you'll be happy in the end if
long
you
run.
Ever had it. Yeah, in the long run for sure. So
okay,
all right, Jim,
awesome. All right, thank you very much.
Hey, yeah, no problem at all. Great question, great topic. Something we run into in St. Louis all the time here. So I think we'll get into our break here, and then we'll get to some more calls right after we come back. You can get to me again. Remember, 314-436-7900, and we'll be right back after this.
This is the KMOX Home Improvement Show,
presented by Suburban Leisure Center, the place with the big red chair.
Now, Scott Mosby on the voice of St. Louis KMOX.
All right, here we go. We are back. Rich Orris here again, filling in for Scott Mosby today. You know, I enjoy this so much. I love all the information, the calls, the questions. Love helping out. If you've got anything for me, feel free to call in 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. And we have Kim on the line here, has a question for us. Kim, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Awesome. What do you have going on? Thanks for calling today.
Well, probably a problem everybody has.
Yeah.
It's just a musty-smelling basement. Not musty in the sense it's damp and all that, but just like stagnant. There is a register in the ceiling in each room down there, but you have no cold air returns or anything. Is it just a lack of air circulation, and you have any good ideas for me?
Well, you know, a lack of air circulation can definitely, you know, promote things like that happening. Air movement is definitely good. And the other thing that always, you know, enhances or helps, you know, promote like kind of just a musty kind of area is just the levels of the humidity in the air, you know, at any given certain time. And, you know, this could be either way, you know, a dehumidifier or a humidifier for, you know, like the winter time. But here in summer, you may end up needing a dehumidifier to kind of lower the humidity levels down there. And that could also help, you know, take care of some of that. And basically what I would recommend doing, because you gotta kind of know that that's the case, first of all, you know, before you just get into one or the other. So you can purchase these, they're called digital hygrometers, and they just basically read, you know, what the level of humidity is in any room that you put it in. So I always recommend to everybody to get at least one of these for each floor of their home, because the problem is the basement can be much damper than the first floor and or the second floor. Can be the driest. So you really want to watch it in each area, and, you know, any type of, you know, moisture underneath, water underneath the concrete floor, even if it's not coming in, you know, moisture vapor can just come up through the carpet, through the concrete, and just create kind of a moist area. So I would say put a digital hygrometer down there, and what you want to do is make sure that you get one that shows like spikes. So it will record like the lowest reading that it sees and the highest reading that it sees. Because if you walk down there and you look at it and you go, oh, it's still perfectly fine. Well, 2 days ago, it could have hit 60%. And you might not have known, because you're not going to be just sitting there watching it, or it doesn't have an alarm, you know, or anything like that. So if it shows those spikes, then you can hit a button and go, oh, wow, in the past week, it did get really high humidity. I should consider running a dehumidifier through this time of year, or when there's rainstorms or something like that, you know, go ahead and run it to keep it in a place that you want to be.
Yeah. My only problem there is I don't have a drain to take it to, so I'd have to be running down emptying all the
time. My. So, yeah, so there's no floor drain anywhere that you could put it nearby?
There is in, I'll call it the junk room.
Oh, okay.
But those doors are always closed on that room.
Yeah.
And
so you're going to be dehumidifying a room that you don't use.
Yep.
So if you got one, if you needed a dehumidifier, if you find out your humidity is high and you needed a dehumidifier, you could, you know, you might be able to get one where, because they make them where, you know, some of them, and they'll get a little more expensive this way, but it's actually kind of like your furnace. It's like a hose that all that moisture will come out of. And if you can, you know, run it kind of downhill, like maybe under the door into the junk room to the floor drain, but have the actual dehumidifier. Because I always try and recommend people, unless you got nothing but time on your hands, if you got to go down and keep, you know, bailing out a bucket that's inside this dehumidifier, you know, eventually you're probably going to get to a point where it's just, it'll shut off because the bucket's too full, and it'll just stop working and running. And then you got a bucket of water down there that's actually adding to the relative humidity in the basement, you know, if you don't. So it's a lot to manage. So if you get one that, you know, has the hose and can run to a floor drain, it's just a lot less effort, you know, on you yourself. And the other thing I try and explain, too, with humidifiers and dehumidifiers, even like the ones on your furnace, if it's a humidifier or like a dehumidifier, you set that thing to like 40, and everybody thinks, well, I put it on 40, so my humidity, it should hold the humidity level in that area at 40%, but that's not really what it does, and it's not a perfect thing. So you could set it at like 40 and watch that dehumidifier, that digital hygrometer, to see where it truly is. Because it doesn't necessarily mean it's just going to be there. So you still want to monitor where the levels are, even though you've got your unit, you know, humidifying or dehumidifying, because that's not really what those numbers mean, or that's not really how it always works.
Oh, okay.
You know, and a lot of people, they're like, well, I had it set at 40%. And I'm like, yep. So in where you want to be is between 40 and 50%. Anything
year
above
round?
50 is, yep, year round. If you could keep it at 45% every day, all day, year round, your house would be ideal. In our climate, this is impossible.
Right.
You know, it'll never happen. But if you can keep the spikes, you know, in down around 50 or below, and keep the low points, you know, above 35 or at 40 or more, you're doing real well. You know, stay in that 40 to 50 range.
Right. I was thinking maybe just, you know, running a fan down there, keeping air circulating. Upstairs you have your cold air returns and you have your registers. Yeah. So I thought maybe just a circulation thing. But
you know, it might help. You know, for sure, air moving is definitely better, you know, than not. You know, so another thing that you know, can consider, too, that a lot of people do is just have your actual furnace.
The blower.
Set to, yeah, have the blower to on. You know, it can still heat and cool when it needs to, but if that blower is running, you know, all the time, it's kind of like always having a ceiling fan going in the room. You know, it's just constantly recirculating that air. It'll still move air in the basement if you don't have cold air returns, but it'll still move it around at least. And
right.
That might help also.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the information, and I'll be running out to buy me a hygrometer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, they have them on Amazon and stuff like that, too. I just literally bought new ones for my home, so I just bought like a two-pack of them for, you know, to replace on my first and second floor, because they were kind of older ones that I'd had for a long time. So, yep, they're pretty easy to find.
I probably need to pick up new smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors, too, while I'm at it.
Yeah, they recommend, you know, about 7 years on those, you know, 7 to 12, something like that. So if it's been more than 12, it's probably a good idea to get new ones there, too.
Yeah. Oh, well, I need to get on it then.
All right. Well, hey, get on it, Kim. I appreciate the call and everything. Excellent thought and question, and hopefully that'll help you out a little bit. And so for everyone else, hey, I'm here. I'm ready. We've got another half hour left here to go. So 314-436-7900 will get you right to me, and we'll be back with more of your calls and some more information after this.
This is the KMOX Home Improvement Show.
Presented by Suburban Leisure Center. The place with the big red chair.
Now, Scott Mosby on the voice of St. Louis KMOX.
All right, guys. Rich Orris here filling in for Scott Mosby today. And, you know, all friends, family, KMOX people out there everywhere, we've got quite a bit going still, so you can feel free to give me a call. Any questions you have about your home today, 314-436-7900 is the easiest way to find me. And, you know, I want to talk about, of course, we've been talking so much with water and rains and, you know, how to keep moisture out of our driveways and, well, you know, moisture, well, rain, all that stuff. You know, we build these houses, we do all of this, and in attempts to keep all this out because, you know, Mother Nature is here to tear all this down and bring it all back to the soil, make it all fresh and new again in the way that it should be. And so, you know, that's our battle every day is we're fighting Mother Nature. And, you know, she pretty much always wins in the end, but we can sustain as long as we can. We can do the best things that we can in order to, you know, keep all that out and make it last as long as we can. It kind of made me think about, you know, a client I went to see, you know, just the other day on Thursday that basically, you know, I saw him some years ago and it was really interesting because they had, you know, basically I'm going there, they have three roof leaks that they said that we got three different roof leaks. We're pretty sure we need a new roof. And so I go there and I'm looking at things and, you know, we're walking through and they're like, you know, here's a leak in our bathroom, you know, coming on the bathroom ceiling. It's actually pretty much right around a sun tunnel lens, kind of like a skylight sun tunnel type deal that they had put in the bathroom to get some natural light, you know, in this kind of closed off hall bathroom. And then there's one out in the hallway that's right outside the bathroom. And then there's another one, you know, right at the edge of the wall and the ceiling in the master bedroom. And so kind of started looking around, evaluating, you know, can I go up in your attic? Everyone's always expecting, you know, let's get on the roof. Let's see what's happening. And everyone always suspects that all of these leaks are from, you know, roofing shingles. So I kind of look around, I get up in the attic. Well, so I figure out the leak in the hallway is actually a plumbing vent pipe that was holding water, froze in the winter and split the PVC. And so the vent goes out the roof and water does get into it, and it's meant to drain all the way down out through the basement floor and everything. But if it's not pitched correctly, you know, it's holding water right at the elbow. It split that thing in half. So there's leak number one. We need to fix this plumbing pipe, and then we need to slope it the right way so that, you know, this doesn't occur again. And I go over by the bathroom, and the sun tunnel is just condensating like crazy, because in the attic, of course, it's like being outside. It's ventilating. You know, in the summer, it's so much hotter out there. In the winter, it's freezing cold, like the pipe froze. So it's the same temperature inside that attic as it is outside. So we've got all this condensation coming around from this metal pipe. So nothing really with the roof there. Go over by the bedroom, and you can see where the water's basically coming in the wall at the gable vent from the siding. So the house doesn't have a house wrap. It was built in the early 90s. You know, so when they get wind-driven rains, it's driving in around this gable vent and everything. So although they needed a new roof anyway, surprisingly, none of these three leaks would have actually been taken care of, and they would have probably been quite surprised when all three came back after they painted. So I'm back here. It's like 7 years later. They've got a new leak on the first floor this time. And now basically, it's kind of that, you know, it's in the living room right next to the garage. So you've got the roof over the garage on the side of the house that dives into the wall on the side of the home. And this is right over their living room. And they got three or four different area spots where this water is dripping down, you know, on their living room ceiling. Again, you know, this is a product of that wall. This is, you know, the step flashing from the shingles is up onto the wall and everything behind the vinyl siding. But, you know, they don't have any protection from the water, like we were talking about that power washer. Don't blow, you know, water behind the seams, up at an angle, inside the siding. You don't want to force a lot of water around this siding, because water gets behind vinyl siding as it runs down that siding, runs down that wall. It literally goes behind that step flashing. So now you've got, you know, all the right flashings in place and everything, but the water coming from the top getting behind it, so you can't really keep it out that way. So many, you know, of these leaks I see, everyone calls about, I've got a roof leak, and they all, you know, they call these roofing companies, which I do kind of warn that, you know, there's different things that a roofing company is going to look at the roof. Majority of them, that's all they focus on. Some leaks are multi kind of portional tasks, come from different areas sometimes. So, you know, like you think you got these leaks and maybe one of them's from the roof, but the other two aren't. And you don't investigate everything and you fix everything and you fix the roof, and then two leaks come back and you're wondering why. This is the case I see, you know, working here for Mosby, going out and looking at all this stuff all the time for everybody, is so many of these leaks are more a product of the siding, the flashing, and the wall than they actually are the roofing shingle itself. And so many of them have, you know, they're like, I just don't get it. The roofer showed up and he said, there's nothing wrong with your roof. And I'm like, yeah, no, he's right. You know, he just doesn't understand the wall system and where it's coming from. So this is a valid thing, you know, to think about. So for this house to fix this roofing leak, we're going to pull off siding. We're going to flash it right. We're going to make the flashing, you know, do what we call a kick-out flashing, where the wall ends at the roof. You want that step flashing out through the corner of the siding. You want it to come out on top of the shingles and really see that when the water runs down that seam, you know, that intersection where the wall meets the roof, it's going to come out onto the roof at the bottom and not affect. And, of course, for them, that's the biggest spot they have. The, you know, the water stains are kind of lighter and they get darker and darker. And when you get to where that wall ends, it's the biggest, darkest stain right at the end because all that water is getting stopped right at that siding corner and it can't get out. And so 80% of it is actually collecting in that area as it runs down that wall and down that step flashing. So definitely something to think about and get to somebody like us at Mosby here that understands the whole house as a system that can really examine all these things and just be an advisor to really tell you this is kind of what's going on and these are the different things and it's not always, you know, what you think it might be or what you think you might need isn't always the best thing to do. So it's great to think about. So for everybody out there, I think we're going to get into our last break of the show here. We'll have one segment left. If you have a question, comment, concern, anything going on, again, you can find me at 314-436-7900. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back after this.
This is the KMOX Home Improvement Show.
Presented by Suburban Leisure Center. The place with the big red chair.
Now, Scott Mosby on the voice of St. Louis KMOX.
All right, here we go. Final segment today. Having such a good time. Got some great calls. And speaking of that, we got Janet or Jeanette on the line with us. You have a question for us. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks for calling.
Thank you. It is past time for me to get a new basement exterior door.
Okay.
So I have some questions. One, I wanted to see what your thoughts were on wood versus the metal. And then the door is 75 inches by 32. It's an old house. The door right now is wood, and it's probably at least 50 years old.
Okay.
So, and I wanted to know if I got a metal door, if I got it like an 80-inch, if the metal door could be cut down.
That is definitely a great question because I would definitely recommend something other than just wood, although it depends on how you're trying to install it, but just wood is really the only door that's going to be able to be cut down of that magnitude, you know, like 5 inches in order to make it work.
Okay.
I would say a steel or fiberglass entry door would be good, long lasting. You know, it would have a lot of value to it, but you would have to specially order and make that door to come in full jam and everything to where you pull out the wood door, the jam, everything around it, and you install a whole new door system with the frame and the trim and everything. That's either fiberglass or steel, and that would work really well, but you're into all of that custom sizing and making and things like that.
Right.
If you buy a steel door and you try and cut like 5 inches off of it, one, it's pretty hard to cut steel because it'll heat up and burn and things like that, but it'll also, it has like kind of a foam interior, and you'll be cutting off.
That.
Yeah, you'll be cutting off. So at the bottom of the door, it's going to have like a composite piece of material, almost like a piece of wood that helps it be strong and sturdy. And your bottom of it, you know, with the sweep and everything, kind of nails, attaches, screws to that. So that's only going to be about an inch and a half or 2 inches tall. So when you cut off 5 inches, it all goes away and you have no way to really attach the bottom or to keep it solid and steady. So that's why you'd want to do the whole thing. Your only other option is to just buy a door slab and cut it solid wood and cut it to fit inside that existing frame. This is going to take some talent, you know.
Is wood still the better insulator? Or
no, not really. They're all pretty good because they're all that thick, but the fiberglass or the steel, the foam, the things inside of there are very good insulators. And when you buy the whole door system frame, you know, it's going to have all the weather stripping and all that. It's all factory put together and applied. So it's going to seal better.
Yeah. I was told that I don't need the frame, I guess, because of the, you know, like I said, it's a very old house.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yep. So they're probably thinking buy a wood door, cut it the shape and size that you need. It has to be solid wood door, not a hollow core, but a solid one. And then you mortise the hinges and you drill for the doorknob and do all that. And then you can install a new door into that existing frame.
Okay, that gave me a thought then. So if I got a wooden door, because I can't get a wooden door made at 75 inches, they said it's smaller than what they make.
Yeah.
Even custom. So if I got an 80-inch wooden door, that could be cut down okay.
Yes, if it's solid wood, it absolutely can.
Yeah, I'll just do that. Okay. Yep. All right. Well, thank you for the information. I thought I'd get your professional opinion on it all. So,
thank
you very much.
You are very welcome. Good luck with that, Jeanette. And I appreciate the question and the call. And, you know, that does bring up a very good, very interesting topic of, you know, how to install that. Because, you know, in today's environment, that what we were just talking about, replacing the wood for wood in the existing frame, is a very time-consuming, you know, system. It's a very time-consuming thing to do, and it takes skill. You're going to, you know, you want to be a skilled person or have a lot of time to take your time and figure it out and get it right, because you're probably buying this perfectly squared rectangular door and your opening is really not that. You know, it's probably out of square a little bit if it's a very old home, you know, like we were talking about. So you're trying to cut this thing to fit, but also cut it crooked to fit in that frame and then mortise in hinges and get this thing working and line up the lock and drill for the lock. The thing is, this can actually be more costly in a professional environment because labor, you know, we're in the labor shortage. We've got all this stuff going on. We're constantly, you know, all the trades are raising those labor rates to keep good people, and we don't have enough people. So to keep them around, you got to pay them well. So that can be sometimes more or the same as that door replacement. But when you get that whole door replacement with the frame, with everything, you've got this factory finish, this factory mold, this, you know, factory put together in a conditioned environment to make this door work exceptionally well. And the weather stripping and how it seals can be more important than is the system itself solid wood or steel or fiberglass with foam inside or whatever. You know, how much temperature does it hold back and how well insulated is it? You know, air infiltration is really what is the bane of all our existence, and that's what you're battling a lot of times when you're replacing that door. So a lot of work to do that. I give everybody some thought, you know, to think about how you want to take care of that and how you want to do that. So, hey, we are out of time here, totally running out, but thanks for all the calls. I had a great time filling in for Scott again this week, and we'll do it again soon. And everybody have a good week, and I'll talk to you later.